Interview with Dan Gelzer, April 15th, 2008, in Washington, D.C., by Kenneth Durr. Well, the most interesting thing I noticed right off the bat was that you are both an accountant and have a law degree.
Right.
Which I'm sure, you know, is a fairly unusual thing. How did that happen?
Well, my dad was an accountant, was a CPA, and so I guess for a long time I was interested in studying accounting, too. Although I think by the time I started college, certainly, I pretty much knew that I wanted to go to law school. So I never was really exactly aiming at a career in accounting, but I thought it would be a good undergraduate background.
So where did you go to school?
University of Wisconsin.
Okay.
At the time that I was at the commission, John Huber, who was the corporation finance director, David Reuter, who was the chairman during part of that time, and I were all University of Wisconsin Law School graduates. We're very proud of that.
Was that a coincidence?
It was a coincidence, yes.
And then you were pretty clear that you were going to go to law school after that, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And were you thinking in terms of a legal practice that would bring some of this accounting in? How did you end up in the area of securities?
Really just by happenstance, I guess I would say. I mean, I should add that I was out for a year between undergraduate and law school, and I worked for what was then called Touche Ross Bailey and Smart in Wisconsin and in Milwaukee. It would be Deloitte and Touche today.
Right.
So I had a little bit of auditing. But and then after I graduated from law school, I clerked for a federal judge for a year, Tom Fairchild, on the Seventh Circuit, and I just thought it'd be interesting to be in Washington for a little while. I was interested in something connected to business, but I'd never had a special interest in the securities law or the SEC. I interviewed at the tax division of the Justice Department and at the SEC, and I thought the SEC might be a little more interesting.
Who did you interview with?
That's a good question. The most striking thing, certainly, about that interview was, perhaps you've heard this from others, in those days, at least, in the general counsel's office, without advance warning, when you came in, they sat you down and had you take a little written test.
They
gave you and I don't remember the specifics of it anymore, but they gave you a problem, and you had to write an answer sort of along the lines of what you would be doing in writing an appellate brief. My recollection is they told you the relevant law, so it wasn't a test on the law. It was more of a test of writing ability. And then I think this certainly came as a shock to me.
Wow.
I think it came as a shock to many other people who confronted it. And then you would take your paper around as you interviewed in the office, and people would read it. They might ask you questions about it, and that was kind of what the GC interviews consisted of. I don't remember specifically. I would imagine that Larry Nierheim was the general counsel at that time, so I probably talked to Larry. Dave Ferber was, his title then might have been associate general counsel or something like that, but he was running the appellate litigation part, so I probably talked to Dave. I think I also interviewed in market regulation and opinions and review. And I remember, at the time I thought, gee, opinions and review seems pretty interesting, but I decided that I would prefer the general counsel's office.
Justice Department in the running at all? Or?
Yes. In fact, I had an offer from the tax division of the Justice Department, and I didn't really have strong feelings about any of it, but I thought, SEC might be a little more interesting than tax law.
So when you came in and you started working, what kind of jobs did they provide for a new guy?
In those days, the office, I believe when I started, there were 35 people in the general counsel's office, which would be between a third and a fourth of what it is today. I think most of what the office was doing was appellate litigation. Certainly one of the early things I was assigned to was a case against the commission called NRDC versus SEC, the National Resources Defense Council, was trying to compel the commission to require greater environmental disclosure from public companies, and they had arguments that we were required to do that under the National Environmental Policy Act. So I was involved in writing the commission's brief, and this was a district court case at that time, defense against in that litigation. The district court, I think, ordered us to do something or other. I don't remember the exact terms of the order, but we lost. We went to the Court of Appeals. It's hard to remember whether we went to the Court of Appeals at that point or later, but the bottom line was we then had to have a sort of a rulemaking proceeding about environmental disclosure. And that, you know, I don't think this was a high priority on the commission's list, but since they had lost the case, they had to do it. And so I was assigned to that along with two also very young attorneys from Corporation Finance. So we heard these witnesses about what should be in the SEC's rules, and then we had a rulemaking proceeding with a proposal, and those rules are still largely in the commission's rules today. The commission adopted the rules, and then NRDC essentially said they were inadequate and challenged us again. I guess that was the Court of Appeals phase of the case, and so we prevailed in the Court of Appeals, and that was the end of the environmental rulemaking. But I mean, at the time, I thought it was just a fascinating introduction to the agency in administrative law, because you saw defense of a case against the agency, and you saw the rulemaking process, so the internal commission decision making on the subject. It was a good introduction. It didn't have a lot to do with securities law per se, but had a lot to do with administrative law.
Okay. And that was pretty typical. You continued to be involved in cases of that sort?
Actually, that was probably atypical. I mean, I was also involved in some sort of, so you would say, garden varieties of appeals from injunctive actions and appeals of administrative orders that the commission had issued in disciplinary cases against broker dealers, or appeals from NESD cases, that kind of thing. That was probably most of what the office was doing in those days, was that sort of enforcement-related appellate litigation.
Okay. Were there things like special projects that would come up? The SEC is focusing on X, and we want you guys to think about this a little bit.
Well, yeah, and I suppose maybe, I don't know if I'd call it a key to my success, but sort of something that made me a little unique is I guess I was involved more in these special projects like NRDC than just the kind of run-of-the-mill appellate litigation.
Okay.
And certainly something else that rapidly became a big issue in the general counsel's office in those days was foreign payments.
Yeah.
And the commission's response to the, it's what you call the foreign payments crisis, which began kind of went through phases. The commission had several enforcement actions against public companies that had admitted to or as part of the Watergate investigation somehow been discovered to have been making illegal foreign payments.
Right.
Then companies began making disclosures outside of the enforcement process, and the commission had what was called the voluntary program, where I think eventually upwards of 400 companies made disclosures. I do remember sort of a memorable event along the lines there. I think the agency must have been promising some sort of confidentiality to companies that made voluntary disclosures. Mm-hmm. I've forgotten the details, but we received a subpoena from a congressional committee asking for all of the records relating to these corrupt payment disclosures. And Harvey Pitt was the general counsel at that time. Ralph Ferraro was the chairman's executive assistant. And they organized this massive all-night project, which was typical of how things were often done in those days, to prepare a response to the subpoena. I think we had a petition to Congress to quash the subpoena. We had papers to file the next day in court to block enforcement of the subpoena. Letters to the congressional, the chairman or whoever the committee was. It was a full court press to address this problem. And I think the next day, probably Rod Hills went over and just negotiated some settlement with the congressional committee, and all the work was for naught. But it was at the time, I guess it seemed of annoying and burdensome to have to work all night on this stuff. But in hindsight, it, you know, it's the sort of thing you remember for
a long time. A hothouse kind of atmosphere, I guess. What was it like working for Harvey Pitt in those days?
What was it like? I remember one. I mean, Harvey was and still is, I think, an extremely hardworking, dedicated, intense kind of guy. I mean, I can remember one Saturday. I was in the office doing something. I was a staff attorney, so as I say, the office wasn't too big. It got to be, I don't know what, 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and he was working also. We both lived in Maryland, and had some conversation. He said, well, I'll give you a ride home. I just have to work a little bit longer. So I went back to my office. 4 o'clock turns into 5 o'clock. We're going pretty soon. Well, I just have to work a little bit longer. And I think I finally got home like at 9 o'clock. If I'd taken the bus home, I would have been home hours earlier. And that, you know, that was kind of what Harvey was like. And I remember some other staff attorney complained about working too much, or can we take time off and we're not busy or something like that. And Harvey's answer was, hey, you don't have to come in at all as far as I'm concerned. Just get all your work done. But of course, everybody was always in a position where to already get all your work done. You had to be there about the same hours that Harvey was working. So that it was demanding. It probably wasn't exactly everybody's cup of tea, but I liked Harvey a lot, and I think he was good training for a young lawyer.
Well, one of my questions was about enforcement, and you know, the mid to late 70s here, you're really looking at a period where enforcement in some sense is setting the agenda. And I wondered if you got that sense from where you were in the general counsel's office.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, Stan Sporkin was certainly it's probably fair to say the major figure at the commission in those days. Something else that happened, though, with Harold Williams and continue with John Shadd, was I think there came to be concern that enforcement was too much dominating mm-hmm. the agenda, and there were a series of cases now. I have to think back to what they were, but there were not. But the commission had some losses in the courts in the enforcement program. I think there was some concern about whether materiality was being defined too much through enforcement, and there should be some regulatory guidance. But the bottom line of all this was that the general counsel's office then went through some fairly substantial transformations in the late 70s, beginning when Ralph was general counsel and continuing when I was general counsel.
Right.
And most notably, the creation of the counseling group, which is now unit in the office that does non-litigation work. This when I was there, monitors what each of the other divisions are doing, reviews everything that's on the calendar from the other divisions, and you know, presents a sort of an independent viewpoint to the commission. And that was really a big change. I mean, I think particularly for people who'd been there a long time, I think it seemed to be sort of a breach or a rupture in the collegiality that had always marked the agency. Stands around, I'm sure he can speak for himself, but I always thought that probably had something to do with his going over to the, leaving the commission and going over to the CIA as its general counsel.
Now, was this something that came in with Ralph Ferrara? Was this his mandate when he was appointed general counsel?
Yeah, I think, and again, I certainly wasn't directly privy, at least as far as I remember, to the conversations between Ralph and Harold on that subject, although I was in the chairman's office by that time. But yeah, I think it's pretty clear that Harold wanted the general counsel's office to play a more active role in giving the commission this sort of, you know, independent advice, pretty along the lines of, gee, if this matter before us here is litigated, are we going to win? You know, don't just tell us, is this good policy or sort of good for investors in the abstract, but is it something we have a strong legal basis?
How hard was it to shift the general counsel's office into a role like this? What kinds of things had to be done?
Well, I suppose the main thing that had to be done was you had to create this counseling group. I mean, I think when I arrived in the office, I guess as I've said already, litigation, particularly appellate litigation, was really the focal point, and it must have been, I don't know what, 75, 80, maybe more than that, percent of the work. In fact, I remember when I started, they had a practice where each weekend, each week, one poor junior staff attorney would be assigned to read everything that was on the commission's calendar for the following week, and then meet with the senior people in the office, the general counsel and the, I guess, the associates and assistant general counsels, and describe each of these items so that the office could decide whether there's anything they were concerned about. And when you were assigned to do that, you just knew, you know, you weren't going to be doing anything that weekend except reading the calendar. Yeah, because you might have 30 or 40 items. They might involve, you know, who knows what, the net capital rule or, you know, stuff that if you're a new attorney, you never heard of before, so you'd have to sort of study the legal background in order to understand the memo. That was a pretty burdensome thing. Well, okay, that turned then from one person doing it as kind of a sideline from the real appellate work to a group of, when I was there, I guess it was three assistant general counsels, each with a special counsel and probably three or four staff attorneys, and, you know, a group of 20, 25 people who were dividing this work up and really looking closely at the calendar items.
Now, my understanding was they were sort of trying to help channel things to the commission, take a look at things before they hit the commission.
Well, yeah, I think we weren't really supposed to be a hold-up in the process, although
right.
I suppose sometimes we were, but I think the usual routine was that we would get things at the same time that the commissioners would, which is usually a week or so in advance, and then on Monday, then we had those same meetings on Monday morning. Except it wasn't just one person reporting. You know, it might be, I don't know what, you know, 8, 9 more than that staff attorneys who divided the calendar up between themselves and the assistant general counsel groups. Like there was one that specialized in market regulation, one that specialized in investment management, and so we'd have a. Anybody from the office could attend, so we would have 30 or 40 people in the room. Usually the divisions like to attend so that they could hear what was being said about their items, and we would talk about each one and decide what position we should take. It kind of, I mean, the process changed a little when John Shadd became chairman, because his request to me, I never took it 100% seriously, but his request to me was, well, I'd like the general counsel's office to oppose everything. In other words, I think we make better decisions when we have a sort of an adversary process. So whatever another division is recommending, you argue against it, like a lawyer, you know, in a court case for an opposing litigant.
Might be a good exercise, I guess.
Well, yeah, it was challenging, stimulating in a lot of ways. It was sort of fun, But, I mean, some things just aren't very controversial, and it's hard to be against them.
Yeah.
And then you do run into elements that, I don't know how to put it. I mean, presumably we're all there to enforce and administer the securities laws, and there are, you know, sort of limits of how much devil's advocacy you want to do in
right.
that, in
and
that
you wouldn't
context.
Do this. You wouldn't take this to the commission and argue.
Oh, absolutely. I mean,
you
yeah,
would,
that was
really.
That was... to
okay.
do that before
so you
the,
really,
the commission.
Truly
yeah.
would argue against everything.
Yeah, well, yeah, as I say, I didn't take it 100%.
Okay. Wow. Okay.
Seriously, but we tried to do it as much as we could, and then we,
I see.
I think for things that we really had a different office position on, we'd write our own memo to the commission. Then we began to prepare for the things that didn't merit a memo, I think we began to prepare internal notes of what our views were, what views we might take, and then I think those started to become circulated outside the office. But it was quite a production. So then I think at the time that I joined the commission, the general counsel would go to a commission meeting, when he or she had something to say. Mm-hmm. It then evolved when I was there, probably when Ralph was doing it too, that you were just there for the whole meeting, you know, to comment right. on everything, or if there were things you didn't have any comments on, maybe the commission would ask you a question or something like that. The general counsel's office became a more influential part of decision making, and to some degree that was intended as a, I won't say a check, but a counterbalance to the great power that the enforcement division had accumulated.
The point being that the general counsel could say whether these things were worth spending our time on, whether we could win these cases or
John kind of pressed it to the limit. Our real guiding philosophy was the one I mentioned before, that if this matter turns out to be litigated, even if it seems like something that isn't likely to be litigated, would we win? How strong is our legal position here? And more than that, even if we know that it's not going to be litigated, are we doing something that's outside the agency's mm-hmm. authority?
Before we move into your moving up and John Shadd's tenure, other areas of focus in the late 70s, market structure was an issue with the unfixing of commission rates. There was some accounting reform going on.
Yeah, to some extent, we're talking more about the time that I was in the chairman's office than sort of my first stint in the in the general counsel's office. But John Moss, forget the details of some of these things, but John Moss was, I believe, the chairman of the House. He must have been the chairman of the Oversight. He must have been what John Dingell was later, and I guess is again today, the chairman of the Oversight Subcommittee of the House, I think it was called Commerce, or Interstate Commerce at that time. And he had held a series of hearings on the accounting profession, which involved various kinds of testimony and reports on our part. We got a little off the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, but that then morphed into the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act and the effort to get the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act enacted. I think particularly the accounting provisions of the Act and the requirements that companies keep accurate books and records and have effective internal controls is something that came from the commission, so I ended up having a lot of involvement in testimony, letters to Congress, attending congressional hearings along with people, and just all the things involved in seeing the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act be enacted, which again, as a reasonably young staff attorney, I thought was just kind of a fascinating introduction to Washington. I can remember a meeting. I don't want to say this in too negative a way, but William Proxmire was really the chief supporter of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, and we had a meeting with him to discuss some, again, I've kind of forgotten the issue, but some important issue, important to us at least, involving the Act. And we made our presentation, and Senator Proxmire turned to his staff and said, "Now, what's my position on this?" And we were just, this is our main ally. He has to ask his staff what's his position. But he was, for whatever he may have had in mind at that meeting, he was a stalwart ally in the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act.
I'm sure you stayed in good touch with his staff person.
Remember who those folks all were at that time. I mean, Lindy Marinaccio was certainly a banking committee staff member on the Democratic side during some of those years, and then he eventually was appointed to the commission. And anyway, you also asked about market structure.
Right.
I guess I was never as deeply as involved in market structure issues as in some other things, but certainly, particularly during the time that Harold Williams was chairman, the 1975 Act amendments had been passed shortly before that, and the commission was really grappling with what it meant to create a national or central market system as the Act envisioned. One of the big arguments in those days was what the fate should be of New York Stock Exchange Rule. I think it started out as Rule 394, and then they renumbered it to Rule 390 that essentially required exchange members to transact, to do their transactions and listed securities on the floor of the exchange, not on other exchanges or over the counter.
So the General Counsel's Office would get into this as a matter of this reviewing what's coming.
Yeah, we would. I mean, again, I think we had less expertise in that area than obviously folks who lived and breathed it in the Division of Market Regulation did. But yes, yeah, we would get involved in it.
Okay. I never.
A lot of what we're talking about now, I remember more from my time in the chairman's office when Harold Williams was chairman, because I think Harold had concerns about sort of, he understood the mandate in the act, but also he was reluctant to conduct too many experiments on the capital markets.
And
in fact, I think he's been quoted, in those days was quoted publicly on something about he didn't want to, you know, be the guy who had to go tell Congress, well, I tried something on the markets. It didn't work, and they blew up. And now we've got to figure out how to put them back together again.
Yeah.
So he was on that subject, at least. I think he was fairly cautious about changes.
So when you talked about, I just want to get a little sense of your movement up through the General Counsel's office, because I know you end up as an executive assistant.
Right. Yeah.
Were you one of these assistant general counsels in the counseling group or staff?
No, I never held the position assistant general counsel. I think, if I remember correctly, I'd been promoted to special counsel, which was the next rung up from staff attorney. But then about that time, and it would have been right after Rod Hills left as chairman, Harold Williams became chairman. Harvey Pitt was general counsel, as he had been. Ralph Farrar was chairman's executive assistant. Ralph asked me to join the staff in the chairman's office. It was in 1978, I'm quite sure.
Mm-hmm.
So I left the general counsel's office and became a special counsel to the chairman. I think we had a four-person staff and four-lawyer staff in the chairman's office at that time with Ralph as the head.
So what was the mission there?
Well, I remember Harvey had been executive assistant to Ray Garrett. Ralph was executive assistant to Harold Williams. And I don't remember if it was one or the other of them or both of them together telling me that the mission of the chairman's staff was to take guys who put on their pants one leg at a time in the morning like everybody else and turn them into the chairman of the SEC in capital letters. So, I mean, a lot of what we did was write, you know, speeches for the chairman, correspondence for the chairman, advise the chairman about what was going on with the staff, to kind of, you know, prep him for meetings with the staff. There certainly was a function of preparing the chairman for commission meetings. As I did some of this myself, but there were more junior people on the chairman's staff. Amy Goodman and George Yersich, primarily, who would review the calendar, you know, the commission's calendar, and, you know, brief the chairman on upcoming items, help him figure out how he should vote. So that, you know, that's what we did in the chairman's office.
So you developed a pretty broad understanding of what the commission was doing, I guess, in order to move into a position like this, and even to do what you were doing before.
Well, yeah, I mean, certainly the chairman's staff has to understand everything the commission is doing essentially on the same terms that the chairman does,
mm-hmm.
because he's running the agency. I mean, obviously, you know, you're getting advice from your division directors and you're the sort of the working staff of the agency.
And this would have been the point as well that a lot of this stuff was happening in the general counsel's office, where the general counsel's office was starting to review what was going to the commission.
Well, right. I think... I remember the sequence of events right. Gerald Ford was defeated and Jimmy Carter came into office. So Rod Hills left as chairman and Harold Williams came on. But Harvey stayed. I think Ray Garrett had appointed Harvey general counsel right before Ray left. So Harvey stayed through Rod Hills' term and then he remained as general counsel at the beginning of Harold Williams' term. But then at some point, Harold Harvey left, and Harold appointed Ralph general counsel, and then I became Harold's executive assistant. Mm-hmm. And you know, continued as Harold's executive assistant until he left at the end of the Carter administration when Ronald Reagan was elected.
Any highlights in there? Any particular issues that stand out?
And working with, I guess I would say this about all of them, but working with Harold was great. I mean, he's just a, you know, tremendous, thoughtful individual and very easy and stimulating intellectually to work with. And certainly one of his big interests was the then, I guess, sort of new subject of directors' responsibilities and the importance of having independent boards. Mm. And I worked on a series of speeches that he gave on that subject. The implementation of the accounting provisions of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act was also a big issue in those days. And I remember we worked on a speech he gave about how the accounting provisions should be interpreted with sort of a reasonableness element to them. I can remember Harold used to have sort of, I guess you could call them retreats, meetings for the division directors, for the senior staff at his house in Georgetown from time to time, which were kind of fun. He had a pool, I think it was just a lap pool, it was just a one-lane pool in back of his house. As it was in Georgetown, so he didn't have a lot of land. I think he always used to say, well, anybody who wanted to could, you know, bring their swimming suit along, which nobody did, except at one meeting, Stan brought along his swimming suit. I remember, I think he had sort of like a rubber hat he put over his head and dived in that pool and swam laps while we all watched him. But I don't know. And I certainly remember all the work and discussion with Harold about directors' responsibilities and corporate governance. Commission did, Amy Goodman then got involved in a study of corporate governance that Harold had the commission do around that time, which I think really had a big influence on the rest of her career. I mean, she's certainly still involved to this day in those kinds of issues.
Well, was this new look at corporate governance part of the fallout from the Foreign Corrupt Practices?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I think that the events that led to the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act really caused people to sort of ask themselves how corporations were governed in a way that they hadn't before. Yeah.
Did your previous life as an accountant help you at all when you started talking about the implications of accounting?
Well, of course, I had a pretty brief life as an accountant. I was at the bottom end of the food chain in conducting audits. I mean, it certainly was helpful to have studied accounting and, you know, being able to understand what was being discussed when accounting concepts arose. Clarence Sampson was the commission's chief accountant during most of those years. I'm another, just a tremendous guy. I remember Clarence used to say that I knew just enough about accounting to be dangerous, but not enough to actually be right about anything. Because, of course, I felt some restraint, I guess, about telling Market Reg too much what they ought to do in terms of market structure. I felt no restraint at all in those days in telling chief accountants office what they ought to be doing. And Clarence and I actually got along very well, but I was probably a little annoying to him sometimes.
Well, and then Williams went out and Shad came in.
Right, yeah. I mean,
and you stayed in you moved up to take Ralph Ferrara's position. You became
While Harold Williams was chairman, yes.
Yeah, okay.
And when Harold left, Ralph was still general counsel, so I became associate general counsel for counseling. As I became the head of the counseling group, if I remember correctly, on March 1st, what year would that have been? 1981. March 1st, 1981.
So you're back in the general
counsel's office. Harold is gone. John Shad hasn't been confirmed yet, so we don't have a chairman. John was nominated. Of course, one of the things that the commission's staff always does, usually led by the general counsel's office, is help prepare nominees for their confirmation hearings. So Ralph and I and a handful of others, I guess the job fell primarily to me, again, because of the counseling group's hopefully broad understanding of everything going on at the commission, spent a lot of time, you know, prepping John for his hearings, explaining to him what the issues were and the kinds of questions he was likely to get and that sort of thing. And I guess he and I hit it off pretty well. So after he was confirmed, then he asked me if I would come back to the chairman's office again and be his executive assistant. So I was associate general counsel for counseling for 3 months, I believe, and then back to the chairman's office again.
So what was it about John Chad that made you hit it off? Was he particularly easy to prep? Did he pick this stuff up well? Did he have deep understanding?
John was an interesting guy. I mean, he was very conservative. He was a believer in free markets and very skeptical, I guess, to put it nicely, about regulation. And sort of, you know, I don't know, skeptical, I guess, about the SEC staff in a way that Harold and others I'd worked with weren't. Mm-hmm. John also, he liked to argue. You know, I guess it kind of goes back to this point about, well, you know, please oppose everything, because he liked to do that himself, to, you know, debate things and, you know, wasn't quite like this, but, you know, if you said the sky was blue, he might say it was black, just to see how you responded, if you could defend your position. But at the end of the day, I think John felt deeply, maybe more deeply than he should have, that he didn't really understand the laws and the rules that the commission administered. He needed advice to guide him. And so while he might argue with you, and at least in my case, if I said, John, you just can't do it that way, he'd say, okay. So he was a very interesting guy to work with from that perspective. I mean, he'd been, I guess he spent his whole professional career at E.F. Hutton and investment banking. He'd gotten a law degree at night, just sort of for the heck of it. So he was a lawyer, but he never bothered to take the bar exam because he never envisioned practicing law. So he certainly had some grounding in law, and he certainly was familiar with securities regulation, at least as it affected his work as an investment banker. But you know, as I say, I think he felt, maybe more than he should have, but I think he felt that there was a lot he didn't understand about the SEC. And so, I think a lot of people might say to you, well, he was stubborn and difficult to give advice to, but I found that actually, at the end of the day, the opposite was true. If you told him he just couldn't do something, or he had to do something a certain way, okay, I will.
But he wanted to argue about it first.
Well, yeah, he liked the intellect. I mean, he was a very intelligent guy. I mean, not in the same sense that some of the others were, but he liked the intellectual give and take, and I think he felt strongly that truth or the best answer would emerge from a give and take among people.
Well, speaking of give and take, I know one of the notable things you were involved with him in was the accord with the CFTC.
Yes, that's certainly true. I mean, Ed Green, who was the general counsel at that time, was also was probably the lead person who negotiated that, but certainly what the SEC folks called the Shad-Johnson Accord, and what the CFTC folks called the Johnson-Shad Accord was an important issue in those days, yeah.
Well, where did that come from, and how much play was there? How could it have turned out significantly different?
I hope I remember all this correctly, but I think the thing that set it in motion was that the commission had approved options trading on Ginnie Mae's, and the CFTC took the position that since there was futures trading on Ginnie Mae's, they were a commodity, and since the CFTC has exclusive jurisdiction over futures trading, including options on commodities, that we couldn't we lack the authority. And there was litigation. I guess I think the Board of Trade, Chicago Board of Trade, probably sued us, if I remember correctly. Okay. Basically, they won. And I think people at the SEC were a little stunned by all this because, I think, I mean, obviously by the time the litigation was going on, people looked into it deeply, but sort of offhand, the average person at the SEC thought, commodity, that sounds like, you know, corn and right. wheat and stuff right. like that, not Ginnie Mae's securities. Everybody knows that's a security. But to me, at least, we came into the negotiations with kind of in the weaker position because the statute did give them exclusive jurisdiction and we'd lost the Ginnie Mae case. Okay. But so, I think Shad and Johnson eventually negotiated what was a reasonable accommodation that envisioned that, you know, options on securities could trade on securities exchanges. There would be no futures on individual securities. Futures on stock indices could trade on futures exchanges, but the commission would have a sort of a veto power if it felt there was a particular future on an index could be used to manipulate the securities markets. And Congress eventually, you know, ratified, or, you know, wrote that into law, ratified it. And I guess it's worked reasonably well in a world where you have two different agencies regulating different parts of what, you know, because you would broadly call the financial markets. Now, you know, these issues never go away. I mean,
that's,
you know,
sure.
A couple of weeks ago, we have the Treasury proposing that the SEC and the CFTC ought to be merged. And I think right. a little before that, the SEC chairman and the CFTC chairman announced some new record or procedure about how overlapping products would be right. approved. So these... That issue particularly just keeps morphing, but it yeah. hasn't been solved yet.
Well, it put it on the back burner for a little while anyway.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, it let developments in the market go ahead without a regulatory turf war, essentially stepping the markets mm-hmm. from mm-hmm. doing things.
So you would have gone in as general counsel sometime shortly after that?
Yeah. Yes, let's see if I can do the dates. Now, I went back to the chairman's office, and I believe... June of 2001, shortly after John was confirmed, or around the time he was confirmed, and then I
1981,
and then I worked as his executive assistant and became general counsel in. I think he actually appointed me in late 1982.
Okay.
I went downstairs and started working in, I think, in January of 1983.
Okay. What did it look like? Sitting in that desk for the first time, having been on the other side for so long.
Well, let's see. How old was I in 1983? I was 36. So, while I was... Harvey Pitt had certainly beaten me in terms of being a younger general counsel. I felt like I was a surprisingly early stage in my career to have this responsibility. Uh-huh. It's sort of awe-inspiring, I guess.
Well, what was awe-inspiring about it?
Well, I mean, by then the office was must have been in the neighborhood of 80 or so people. It was much larger. I mean, there were people around me that just had so much more experience and seniority with the commission, and Paul Gonson, who was in the general counsel's office when I arrived in September 1st, 1974, and he was there when I left May 31st, 1990, and he's a terrific guy to work with, and he's just been a mainstay of the general counsel's office, mm-hmm. gone now, but was a mainstay of the general mm-hmm. counsel's office for many, many years. Steve Ferber was can't remember. I think Dave was still in the office doing appellate litigation when I came in as general counsel. Jake Stillman was certainly there. I mean, just, you know, again, it's awe-inspiring to be the head of such a, you know, a terrific group of securities lawyers.
Mm-hmm. Was there a sense of what the priorities might be? I mean, there were some external things happening at this point.
Yeah, I mean, and we've talked about and procedurally about the kind of role that John wanted the office right. to play. Certainly, the big issues in those days, well, it was the era of hostile tender offers.
Right.
Somewhere along the line there, the commission had appointed an advisory committee on tender offer regulation. I don't remember where that stood when I became general counsel, but there was just a lot of foment about how tender offers should be regulated. The other big issue, and other big issue in those days, was the law of insider
right.
trading. I mean, it had the Chiarella case, which was a very divided Supreme Court opinion, but it did seem to provide some basis for a misappropriation theory of insider trading. Although, of course, Chiarella got off. I mean, you
right.
can't say that the case stood for misappropriation.
But you could interpret it that way.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was Paul Gonson doing that. Right?
Paul was certainly involved in it. I think Don Langebort.
Okay.
A lot of the work on writing the Chiarella brief, if I remember correctly, too. And then, well, again, you could check if my dates are right, but
sure.
my recollection is that just about the time, shortly after I came to the office, the Supreme Court decided the Dirks case,
right.
which also was a kind of a loss, but opened up new vistas for theories about Tipi liability in particular. So it seems to me that a lot of what we're doing in the litigation side in the general counsel's office in those days was trying to develop, flesh out the law of insider trading, and then also deal with the tender offer phenomenon. We had amicus briefs on the tender offer rules, and we're very interested in the relationship between state and federal law, preemption of, where we'd accomplish it, of state anti-takeover statutes, type of thing.
And did you have different teams? One team's looking for the insider trading, the other team's looking at tender offers? Or were people just sort of passing folders back and forth?
My recollection is that back up a step. I mean, I think when I arrived in the office, it was divided into three general groups. I mean, the counseling group
okay.
and the assistant general counsel groups in counseling did specialize to some degree.
Okay.
Although I think Diane Sanger's group did both tender offers and insider trading, and she had Corp Fin issues, if I remember correctly. But in any event, then there was a general litigation group that defended cases against the commission, did FOIA litigation, and did professional disciplinary proceedings. You know, the commission wanted to bring in a ministry case against an accountant or a lawyer. And then there was the appellate litigation group. And to the best of my recollection, appellate litigation didn't divide up by specialties. I mean, I think it was the sort of thing where if you had one type of case and then a similar case came along, they were likely to assign it to you. But best I recall, there wasn't sort of formal specialization in appellate litigation. Jake Stillman was the associate general counsel heading that group.
Given the way insider trading was developing, I mean, it seems that you're looking for cases, you're looking for the implications of various cases, right?
Yeah, well, of course, this, unlike some other things, perhaps, I mean, this is one where you can kind of see the process all the way through, because the enforcement division is investigating the cases and then coming to the commission with a theory as to why this would be a valid enforcement action. And, again, in the light of Dirks, you got into questions like, it's a tipping case. Well, was there a personal benefit to the tipper? What was that benefit? Can we call enhancing your reputation a personal benefit? Does it have to be something monetary? And the same token, a lot of questions came up about the misappropriation theory and duties you might owe to who knows who, family members and stuff like that. So we were able to advise on the sort of at the formation stage when enforcement brought the cases, and then if they did become appeals, then then they became ours to defend the theory
right.
In the Court of Appeals.
And was Dirk's something that you worked on that your office
no,
worked on?
No, Dirk's. Well, I, yeah, the it all happened before I got there. I think the case had been, the briefing was certainly, I think the argument had taken place before I became general counsel. And Paul did, I'm quite sure Paul Gonson did argue the Dirk's case.
So if you're looking, I guess my question is, everybody knew that there was something in Dirk's that may be useful, that may be provide an avenue. What did you do? Did you run around looking for similar cases?
I wouldn't say that. I mean, it's like, you know, this is one of the famous SEC sayings having to do with Supreme Court decisions was when they decided the Hockfelder case, you know, that there had to be scienter in for a 10b-5 violation. Stan Sporkin is alleged to have, you know, people were upset about it, it's going to be a problem, and Sporkin allegedly said, they want scienter, we'll give them scienter. And I think the reaction was sort of the same to Dirk. So, okay, if in order to make a tipping case, you've got to show that there was some personal benefit to the tipper, then we'll find that. We'll be imaginative in coming up with theories that fit with what the Supreme Court has said is the law. And I guess you could say the same about Chiarella, too. You know, if we're not equal access to information isn't the theory, but you've got to be able to show some sort of a duty breach, okay, well, we'll cast the cases that way. So I wouldn't, and again, we weren't exactly finding the cases in the general counsel, but I would say enforcement reacted more to situations where they thought there had been trading that they thought was, I don't know what you would say, abusive and improper, based on non-public information, and then they would work to fashion the case around what the state of the law was, and we would express our views on how that had been done.
And also on insider trading, and this gets into the international angle. I mean, the Santa Fe case had broken earlier, and you had John Shad and John Fetters going off to Switzerland. I guess, well, Shad didn't, but Fetters went off to Switzerland. Were you involved in any of those?
Well, not directly. I mean, Ed Green, again, Ed Green was general counsel at that time. He was certainly involved in negotiating that Swiss MOU, although, you know, as you say, you know, Fetters was a motivating force behind that. But yeah, I mean, it's absolutely true that one of the, the hostile tender offers spawned the insider trading, and then that in turn spawned issues about, well, what if people conduct their trading from outside the United States? How are we going to be able to get at the information that we need in order to make those cases? And that led to the Swiss MOU. Where was Dennis Levine trading through? The Bahamas? Some Caribbean jurisdiction, you know, it sort of opened up new vistas of issues, at least in the enforcement world, in terms of internationalization and not being able to just kind of stop at the water's edge in terms of administering and enforcing the federal securities laws.
How about in the general counsel's office? Did you suddenly find yourself dealing with issues of international jurisdictions or something like that?
Yes. We were, I guess, were there revisions at that time? But there were issues about the Hague Convention on, I think it's called the Hague Convention on Gathering Evidence Abroad, something like that. So we commented on the revisions to that. And then there were cases that we filed amicus briefs in on the Hague Convention. Now, it's a little harder to bring this up, but there were certainly both SEC enforcement cases and then non-SEC cases where we thought we had an interest at stake. We filed amicus briefs and were, you know, relating to our ability to get evidence from outside the United States or to prosecute, you know, bring enforcement actions where at least some part of the conduct had occurred outside the United States.
Well, if the foreign corrupt, the payments was sort of dominating the late 70s. You had the insider trading was all over the headlines in the mid 80s.
Right.
And, you know, And I would just wonder if to a similar extent, they were driving the agenda in the general counsel's office.
Well, I think the short answer to that is yes. And again, from my recollection, it was this sort of, partly overlapping phenomenon of hostile tender offers and right. insider trading. Because I mean, there was certainly a lot of foment in those days about what the tender offer rules ought to be. Also, I mean, that was largely an issue run out of the Division of Corporation Finance, but we took an interest in those rules. And
well, let's talk a little bit about the tender offer issue, because that must have taken up a good bit of your time during the 1980s.
Well, yeah, I mean, from a litigation standpoint, there certainly were issues. The CTS case.
Right. Early in the decade, you had the Mike case.
Edgar versus Mike, yeah.
Which essentially outlawed a number of
yeah,
schemes.
It struck down the Illinois statute, and and I think it led many people to believe that state takeover statutes were doomed, and then CTS kind of went the other way. It upheld the Indiana statute, which had been narrowed, I think, so it only applied to companies incorporated in Indiana, which had not been a feature of the Illinois takeover statute. So this sort of seemed to mark out a way that the states could put in place anti-takeover legislation. Our perspective in those days, I guess I would say, was, well, I guess it's too simplistic to say it was pro-tender offer, but we felt that the Williams Act laid out sort of what the rules of engagement ought to be for takeovers, and essentially that states shouldn't be able to interfere with that contest.
It's the Edgar versus Mike was like 81, something like that, just as this stuff was really breaking.
Yeah, again, it was before I was in the general counsel office the second time.
It seems like the SEC sat out for a while. Because the hostile tenders were really kicking up in the early Reagan years, and didn't really weigh in for a couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't want to say it in too simplistic a way, but I think John's philosophy, John Shadd's philosophy, was that hostile takeovers were a good discipline on the market, and also very very beneficial for the investors, at least of the target company, and so we should be interfering as little as possible. And there were already tender offer rules in place to prevent could be abuses, I guess it's fair to say in that sense we kind of set things out. I mean, a lot of questions came up, like our big issue in those days was unconventional tender offers. People making open market purchases, or spreading rumors about a takeover or something, so that shares would go into the hands of arbitrageurs, and then simply buying up the shares from the arbitrageurs. So there were we had cases that were involved in beyond the area of the anti-takeover statutes. But then I'd have to look at something to remind me of the exact sequence. But I think it's right then that after, I don't think the commission was involved in Edgar versus Mitre. If it was, I don't recall. But then we did become somewhat more active in filing amicus briefs challenging or supporting challenges to state anti-takeover statutes.
Right. There was one in Delaware in particular.
Well, yeah, that's that was Moran versus Household. Delaware, in the wake of CTS, took a little different spin on anti-takeover and adopted a statute that permitted poison pills. And we filed an amicus brief challenging the validity of the Delaware poison pill statute by a split commission vote. My recollection is that was reflected in the brief. I think it was 3-2 vote, which is not, doesn't help your litigating position until the court were absolutely sure about this by a vote of 3-2. But in any event, we're on the losing side of that case. The statute was upheld, and then poison pills became a fairly common tactic.
Was the commission's position controversial? Because it was real easy to say the good guys and the bad guys. You know, the bad guys are the ones, the corporate raiders coming in, and the SEC seemingly on, by some lights, on the side of the bad guys.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think the answer to that is yes. As the split in Moran illustrates, there certainly wasn't unanimity at the commission. I think those positions were controversial.
And was there pressure to resolve that?
Well, I think we were being sort of, buffeted by pressure in both directions. I remember we hear from Boone Pickens from time to time, and it's hard to remember specific, but I'm sure we heard from the corporations that were the targets of tender offers. And I think that was part of the reason that tender offer advisor committee was formed, to sort of, divert the policy disputes to another group that could try to come up with recommendations to resolve them. It's not unusual in Washington to address a problem by forming a committee to look at it.
Ultimately, it seemed like it all boiled down to dual class stock.
Well, yeah, that's right. That was another part, or maybe close to the end part of the story, when the commission adopted its rule prohibiting, under certain circumstances, the listing of dual classes, so that you couldn't have voting control in one group and have the general public holding another group. And of course, that was a loss for the commission. Also, the Court of Appeals here in town said that the commission didn't have the authority to adopt that rule.
How hard was it to get to that? Because after all, the commission was certainly taking other positions where it was against dual class stock, right? I mean, the New York Stock Exchange wouldn't allow.
Yeah, it was. I wish I could remember a good story to tell you. It was certainly controversial internally, and highly controversial. I know it was a subject that Joe Grunfest was very interested in. He'd been appointed to the commission by that time. I think that, if I remember correctly, that case wasn't. I was gone from the commission by the time the case was decided, but I was certainly there during the time that the debate, and I think there was some kind of public hearing or something, but the various process went on to decide whether or not the commission should adopt the anti-dual class listing standard.
That gets to the question of the commission and the chairman's role and all that, and you were, I guess you're still the longest serving general counsel at the SEC, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. Roger Foster served for quite a while, but I think his titles may have shifted between general counsel and solicitor during part of that time. Unfortunately, Roger isn't still around to ask. Just as a footnote, I should say, I think I mentioned at the beginning the NRDC case that I was involved in early on. Roger Foster was representing the NRDC in that litigation, and he seemed to me quite elderly at that.
Yeah.
Time. It was sort of striking to have a guy that had such a long and illustrious career at the commission was now suing us.
Right. But which now happens all the time.
But he was doing it, obviously from a public interest standpoint, not as a representative of a private interest.
Anyway, I'm pretty sure you get the title. And the point is that you were in there with a lot of different chairmen. And you saw different configurations of the commission, and I wonder if you can provide a sense of how the commission was working together, what the big issues were, particularly in the mid '80s when insider trading, when the commission was really in the headlines.
It's hard to generalize. I mean, I guess it started out sort of a broad statement that. By the time I left, things were certainly a lot different than they were at the time that I got there. And a big part of the change, I think, stemmed from the enactment of the Government of the Sunshine Yeah. And another little project I got involved in back in those days was writing the rules to implement the Sunshine Act, which must have taken effect in the early 80s, I guess. So somewhere around there. And you know, just as an observer, and particularly a pretty young observer at the beginning, in the early 70s, the commission seemed very collegial. The commissions were quite deferential to one another. And while I can't say I ever personally observed it in those days, you kind of had the sense that for most disputes, they'd retire to the chairman's office in private, talk about it, and decide what to do, or something like that, at least. And after I would say the big effect of the Sunshine Act was to make the chairman more powerful, to give him a much bigger role in setting the agenda, because then it was sort of the chairman could meet with the staff freely, but he couldn't meet with his fellow commissioners, so except in a very, you know, kind of formalized, announced to the public kind of setting. And to me, it made the chairman more dominant, and kind of eroded this collegiality that I thought I'd seen in the early years when I was at the commission.
So did John Shadd have problems with this eroding collegiality at all?
Well, I can't think of a good specific to answer this. I mean, you know, John certainly wanted to set the agenda. But I guess I would say the same about Harold Williams and David Ruder and Richard Breeden. I guess there was an element, too, of, I give that little phrase about helping people that put their pants on one leg at a time turn into the chairman. I sort of, following Harvey and Ralph through the commission, I came from a tradition that was chairman centric. You know, we'd spent our formative years trying to make the chairman powerful and important. I remember, this is quite apropos of what you're asking, but to me, one of the kind of dramatic things that happened in those days when John Shadd was chairman, and in a way, I kind of feel like the thing that I had the biggest influence on the law in was the McMahon case, Shearson versus McMahon, which upheld the validity of pre-dispute arbitration agreements. Stemming from some initiatives, I think, or some general philosophical positions the Reagan administration had, was quite skeptical about litigation, particularly litigation against brokerage, for probably a consequence of having worked at a brokerage firm for 25 years or whatever. And I mean, I didn't have that kind of background, but I also had some sympathy with the idea that it might be better if more disputes could be routed into a less expensive resolution mechanism. Mm-hmm. And so when the Supreme Court came to be considering the question of the validity of these pre-dispute arbitration agreements, I had the office take the position or recommend to the commission that we should go in on essentially on the side of Shearson, on the side of the defendants, that the agreement was valid. And that, boy, which I remember the specifics, that must have been a split commission vote, too, although it wasn't reflected in the brief. It was a very contentious issue internally, because traditionally the commission had always taken the position that any kind of agreement to waive compliance or give up something that you had under the securities laws was unenforceable. I mean, there's a provision in the Act that says that, so really the question is the relationship between that provision and the Federal Arbitration Act, and I think the commission had traditionally taken the position that arbitration agreements were unenforceable. Pre-dispute arbitration agreements were, with respect to securities law claims, were unenforceable. But we persuaded at least a commission majority that we ought to go in on the other side of the case. I had people in the office who refused to work on the brief. I mean, they thought it was such an outrageous position to take. But so the Supreme Court did see it our way. I think it's controversial again now. I think there's been some bills introduced in Congress, or at least discussion about legislation to overturn Shearson. But for the last, what would that be, 25 years now, you know, we've had most customer broker disputes have been run in an arbitration system. I mean, Linda Feinberg, who was in the general counsel's office at that time, and she wasn't involved in the case, so I wouldn't be surprised if she was against the commission's view, runs the arbitration program at the NESD or at FINRA now, and has for many years.
So you you submitted a brief on the Shearson side.
Right. Okay. In the Supreme Court, and we hadn't participated in the case earlier.
So the idea among the opponents of this was that if it wasn't settled in court, you really couldn't know where the thing stood.
Well, you're asking why are people against arbitration?
Yeah.
A variety of reasons, I suppose. I mean, and one is at least some people question the fairness of the arbitrators. I think the system the NESD now has is there's supposed to be one industry arbitrator or one person with an industry background. One with a non-industry background. I've kind of forgotten how it's divided up. But people question the fairness of the arbitrators. Discovery is essentially whatever the arbitrators will let you have, and I think in a lot of civil litigation, the threat of costly discovery is one of the clubs that the plaintiff uses in order to get the defendant to settle. That's generally not available in arbitration. Except in extreme cases, there's no appeal. The loser can't take the arbitrator's decision to federal court. Sort of in the abstract, you might say it's hard to see why the system inherently favors one side over the other. The investor advocates tend to feel that it disadvantages investors. I guess my own observation has been that arbitrators tend to split the baby. You know, they won't give the investor perhaps the massive re-judgment that he might get in court. On the other hand, I think there are a lot of cases that if they were litigated, they'd be thrown out in a court where the arbitrators award something to the investor. In general, there are no punitive damages in arbitration either, which is another big club for settlements and at least some types of private litigation. So,
something I want to get to.
I guess I'll bring that up kind of under the heading of the ability of the chairman to set and control the agenda. I mean, I think that's an example of something that wouldn't have happened if John hadn't felt strongly about it.
Right. Well, something I want to get to before we move, get to where you left the SEC, and that's something that clearly becomes relevant now, which is accounting. I think Sandy Burton was doing some stuff back in the 70s, as far as I know Safe Harbor came out late sometime there, and there are some other accounting rule changes.
I'm not sure what you're referring to in terms of Sandy. I mean, when I was in the chairman's office with Harold Williams, and I hope my memory is straight on all this, but I think that's the time when the under pressure from the SEC, the AICPA set up what was called the peer review process, where the firms in effect inspected one another's practices.
Right.
And then also sort of at the same time or as part of that, they set up this thing called the POB, the Public Oversight Board, which kind of oversaw the peer review process.
Did you ever work with them? Did you see what it was they were up to at any point, the POB?
No, I never had any really firsthand contact with them. And it was an issue that was important to Harold, so I'm sort of there as part of the discussions to set up the system. But in terms of personal involvement and seeing how a peer review operated or being part of the deliberations or hearing the deliberations of the POB, no, I never really had any contact with that group. But as I say, the sort of what should regulation or self-regulation be in the auditing profession was a hot issue back in the 70s.
Right.
To some extent, it's always been a hot issue, but it kind of culminated in the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, which created this board and abolished self-regulation. So something else that was a big issue in the Harold Williams days was non-audit services. It was what kind of services other than the audit itself could an accounting firm perform for an audit client. And we adopted a rule, a requirement that required disclosure in the company's filings about, I think it was like rough percentages of what part of the fees went for non-audited services. It was something that was pretty bland by today's standards. The profession hated it. There was a feeling that the information wasn't of much use to investors. And that requirement then was abolished probably while John Shadd was there. But then, of course, the subject of non-audited services came back with a vengeance when, you know, during Arthur Levitt's time as chairman in the 90s, and the Sarbanes-Oxley Act addresses that specifically. So it's always been interesting to me that, like the CFTC, SEC jurisdictional issues, some of these things, they never really go away. They just kind of, you know, morph and change their form.
Did the Treadway Commission have anything to do with accounting practices?
Well, yeah, the Treadway Commission made recommendations. Let me go back a step. I guess during the Harold Williams time also, sometime in the late 70s, early 80s, there were questions about whether there ought to be reporting on internal controls, you know, as a corollary to the internal control provisions of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. But again, there was a lot of opposition to that, I guess, primarily because of the cost and the difficulty, or presumably difficulty, of doing it. The Treadway Commission then, they looked at the profession generally in financial reporting, and I think one of their recommendations then spawned a study of internal controls for public companies, how companies should structure their internal controls, which is called the COSO report. COSO standing for Committee of Sponsoring Organizations of the Treadway Commission.
Okay.
And that COSO framework remains today sort of the Bible for how companies should measure the adequacy of their internal controls. Well, the Treadway Group did its work, I believe, after I was gone from the commission. Jim was on the commission. I can't remember if he was still there when I left or not, but he was a commissioner during some of those years that I was general counsel.
How much of these accounting and corporate accountability issues would have landed in the general counsel's office, given the nature of the general counsel's office?
It's a tough question. It probably depends a little on how the issue came up. I mean, we generally did congressional testimony and congressional correspondence, so there might be situations where a division would do that. So if the issue arose in the context of something having to do with Congress, we were quite likely to be involved in it. And certainly rulemaking in the area or questions about disclosure would have worked through either Corporation Finance or the Office of the Chief Accountant. But again, as we discussed at the beginning, we felt we had a pretty much a roving commission to offer advice on anything anybody else in the agency was doing. And people were always interested in, certainly in corporate governance issues, and to some extent in accounting regulation issues too, and they're sort of questions that are, for whatever reason, appealing to people.
Well, you touched on the congressional angle and testifying, and I've had people talk about, you know, their least favorite experience or whatever. Do you have any war stories about going up on Capitol Hill and talking?
I don't know if you heard the fireside chat that Giovanni Prezioso and I did a month or so ago about the general counsel's office. I told my favorite congressional testimony story there, and I'm happy to tell it again. It was the Edgar system, you know, the electronic filing system, was devised during the time that John Shadd was chairman. Although one of the things that was important to John was that it be self-funded. Now, it'd be funded by users so that appropriated funds didn't have to be used to support it. And that was not a popular idea in Congress, because obviously anything that's off budget has less congressional control over it. So there were a series of hearings about Edgar, all of which were critical. At least on the House side, because the House was controlled by Democrats throughout that period. I guess the Senate went back and forth. And I remember we got to one hearing, and a congressman, who was Ron Wyden, who is today a senator from Oregon, was then a congressman from Oregon, held up a sign that said Edgar. And he said, you know, this is trying to devise this system, and Edgar's supposed to stand for Electronic Data Gathering and Retrieval. This system won't be able to retrieve data. And he tears the R off his sign. It won't be able to analyze data. He tears the A off his sign. It won't be able to gather data. He tears the G off his sign. So now he's left with a sign that says Ed. And he folds out the front of the sign, which hadn't been visible before, but says Mr. So now he's holding out a sign that says Mr. Ed. And says, and the SEC has as much chance of ever creating this system as it does as finding a talking horse. So I thought that was certainly one of the low points, at least in terms of congressional testimony, but very clever on his part, I must admit.
Points for creativity. Anything else that we should touch on having to do with your time as general counsel?
I guess I can't think of it. It was a terrific time. And, certainly the... Well, I guess I would say the high point of my professional career. Being here has been a lot of fun, too. But it was just an amazing experience. And again, for someone who was at least relatively young at the time that I was doing it.
What was it that made you decide to go back into law practice?
Well, I guess I got to a point where I thought, I'm either going to be here forever, or it's time to try something else. I was, if we can do the years again, I left in 1990, so I was 43, I guess, when I left, and I'd essentially spent my whole professional career at the SEC the past 16 years. It just seemed like it was time, you know. Can I really do this for the, you know, until I'm 65? That doesn't seem quite right. There isn't, I guess you could become a commissioner, but that didn't seem to be in the cards. So there was nothing else really to move to at the commission. It was time to go.
So you went to Baker and McKenzie, right?
Yeah. I guess for some reason we haven't talked at all about David Reuter in this conversation. I mean, David was... John Shadd left to become ambassador of the Netherlands. I don't remember the year, probably 86, 87, something like that. And then David Reuter became chairman. I'd known David, not well, but somewhat before he came to the commission. And again, it was just a treat to work with him. He'd been a law professor for many years. He had a great intellectual interest in the securities laws. But I would say not the same kind of strongly held conservative free market views that John Shadd did. And in some ways, I suppose you could characterize him as the opposite of John Shadd. John was so sort of concerned about whether he really understood the law. David understood the law very well and had been writing and working with it for years. But it was just a treat to work with and a fine guy who I still see very often these days. David went to the Chicago office of Baker and McKenzie when he left the commission. And so then when I was looking around for something to do, I had some conversation with David, and it seemed like maybe it would make sense for me to go to the Washington office of Baker and McKenzie. So that's kind of how I got to to Baker and McKenzie in D.C., and which is okay. the reason why I mentioned David Reuter when you asked me about leaving the
commission. Yeah, well, you know, and he was in place during the market break, right?
Right, yes, yeah.
That, mm-hmm. I mean, that's what you think of.
Yeah.
Did that leave the general counsel's office with anything to do?
It was really much more a market regulation yeah. story. And, you know, Rick Ketchum, who was the market reg director at that time, was certainly the lead person on right. on the market break. I mean, and I think we were involved in some of the congressional testimony. The Brady Commission, I think, was formed then in the wake of the market break, although it was primarily market reg who
right.
dealt with them. So I can't... You know, it was sort of an exciting time in the sense that any crisis provokes... excitement, but it wasn't, to my recollection, primarily a general counsel's office
yeah.
issue.
Yeah. Well, then, so we know why you went to Baker & McKenzie, and did you go into securities law?
Well, yeah, I did a variety of things. I did some representation of people in SEC enforcement matters, advised people on compliance issues. The firm had a lot of foreign clients because it has a lot of, you know, it's kind of a worldwide organization, so it often had issues arising from non-U.S. broker-dealers and investment advisors that wanted to have some contact with the United States, but usually mm-hmm. Prefer to limit that contact in a way they didn't have to actually register with the SEC. I got involved in a practice called global custody then. The firm was already representing most of the large banks, particularly the U.S. banks, that act as custodians and hold the securities of U.S. mutual funds with respect to their foreign investments. There are probably in excess of 100 countries around the world that have some type of securities market, and there may be at least one U.S. mutual fund with investments in each of those markets, and obviously for the major markets, there are many, many U.S. funds that are investing in, you know, U.K. or Japan or wherever. And the SEC has a regulatory system for how those securities are held. But by the time I left, probably at least half of my practice had to do with the global custody banks, Chase, or now J.P. Morgan Chase. State Street is a major custodian. Bank of New York is a major custodian. It was, I said, it was a fun practice because virtually nobody else was doing it. You know, it was a very niche kind of practice. But
how did you get into it?
There was a partner who retired from Baker in the mid '90s who had originally started the practice, and the way the firm got involved in it was under the SEC's regulatory regime, which is Rule 17F5 under the Investment Company Act. The firms needed to get opinions each year about sort of the legal status of the securities that they were holding in each different country. Mm-hmm. And Baker had offices in, I don't know what the count was then, 30 or 40 different countries. So we started out with the advantage of having an office in, you know, not the 90 or 100 countries that are the whole universe, but in more countries than any other law firm did. Mm-hmm. And we've developed correspondent relationships with lawyers that were knowledgeable about investment law in the jurisdictions where we didn't have offices. So we had a sort of a natural advantage in doing this global custody.
So are you looking at foreign securities laws?
Yeah, you're essentially looking at things like, well, State Street will have a correspondent bank or some sort of a bank that it has a relationship with in, I don't know, wherever you like, Tasmania, that's holding the securities of State Street's clients that are invested in the Tasmanian market. Well, questions arise like, what happens if that bank becomes bankrupt? Is the fund going to get its securities, or are they going to be, will the creditors of the bank have claims against those securities? And the arrangement is supposed to be set up in a way that the U.S. investors won't lose their securities because of any problem with the custodian. So that's the type of issue that it's being looked at. And many of these securities are held in not just by individual banks, but in depositories in those foreign jurisdictions. So then you run into questions about how those depositories are regulated and run, and what the rights of depository members are if either a participant in the depository or the depository itself were to fail. Mm-hmm. These failures are sort of remote events, but when you think about the hundreds of billions, trillions of dollars that mutual funds are holding, or that custodians are holding of investments of mutual funds, people take pretty seriously any risk that the custodian bank might have to make good on
on
any of those losses.
How well did your SEC experience prepare you for this?
I'm not sure I'd ever heard of Rule 70F5 when I was at the commission.
Yeah, one of the focuses of this sort of phase of the Oral History Project is Internet Matters International. My research didn't turn up that you had a great deal international matters. It's fascinating that you came up with this after you left. Yeah. A really unusual niche that I'd never even heard of.
I can't say that I knew or learned anything in particular about mutual fund custody of securities when I was at the SEC. Although I think for a lot of securities practice, a lot of people practicing securities laws, it's sort of knowing the agency, knowing who does what at the agency, knowing who to call if you have an issue, kind of having a sense of how the staff's likely to react to a particular kind of problem. I think one of the fun things about securities laws is it morphs, it changes so much. 3 years ago, people weren't thinking about the impact of subprime loans on brokerage firms. Now, I'm sure there are a lot of people that are thinking about that.
Do you deal with the international division at the SEC very much? Paul Dudek, his office?
Currently?
Yeah. Or through that work?
Well, it wasn't the Dudek, Ethiopis, Michael Mann group that we dealt with in private practice. It was the folks in investment management who interpreted the 40 Act rules primarily, I guess, in the chief counsel's office in investment management.
Okay. And then I suppose you were sitting there watching what Arthur Levitt was doing through the 90s with some of the corporate accountability stuff that, it all came up and it all got shot down. Tell me a little bit about being approached for the position that you're in now, for the seat on the PCAOB and the decision to take it.
Well, I was, following the events that led to the enactment of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, and the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, more as a interested observer than anything else. I mean, we were certainly studying Sarbanes-Oxley and going around and making presentations to clients about what it might mean, but I really never thought anything about it having any personal meaning to me in terms of my employment. I had a call from Bob Herdman, who was the chief accountant at the SEC at that time, about would I be interested in going on the board, and would I come in and talk to Harvey about it, which I did. Harvey reminded me that I was a CPA because of him. So we left that part of the story out early. After I got my undergraduate degree in accounting, I took the CPA exam in Wisconsin, and I passed it. And then I worked at the Touche office in Milwaukee for a while. Wisconsin had an experience requirement. You had to pass the exam and have a certain amount of experience in accounting. The time at Touche counted towards it, but it wasn't enough. So after I got to the SEC, and when Harvey was general counsel, he wrote a very glowing, I won't say exaggerated, but very glowing letter about how everything I was doing as an attorney at the SEC was closely connected to accounting, and sent that to the Wisconsin licensing board. I think I have their certificate on the wall somewhere here to indicate that my SEC time should satisfy the rest of the experience requirement, which they then agreed with and issued me my CPA certificate. In fact, when I met with Harvey to discuss coming here, he said he'd gone through his old files in his garage or something to see if he could find a copy of that letter, but he wasn't he wasn't able to, and I wasn't able to either. But I think the more serious version of the story is that under the statute, he had to have two CPAs on the board, two and no more than two. And, you know, I think Harvey was interested in finding people that he worked with or had some mm-hmm. knowledge of, so he felt he would have a good working relationship with them and maybe some understanding of how they would approach the issues. Charlie Niemeyer, who turned out to be the other CPA on the board, was at that time the chief accountant in the Division of Enforcement at the commission, so Harvey obviously knew him and was working with him, and he never put it to me this way. I can just kind of see him then thinking, now, what, you know, what other CPAs do I know that I trust?
Right.
And apparently my name came up. So I guess that's how I came to be appointed to this board.
When you came in, clearly, you know, you're set up by statute, and a lot of your job is laid out. How much was the PCAOB able to sort of make its sort of design its own mandate?
Well, yeah, the statute certainly laid out our job, but I guess in the same sense that what a good metaphor would be a road map showing you where New York is and where Chicago is lays out how you get between one and the other. You still have a lot of choice as to exactly how you're going to do it. I mean, I think, and that's what's made being here professionally fascinating experience. When we started out, we were essentially four board members. Because, of course, our first chairman, Bill Webster, resigned after 2 weeks, and it was quite a while before he was replaced. So it was the four of us and a statute. And we had to create everything else from scratch. So, yeah, I mean, certainly the broad outlines, we have to inspect firms, we have to inspect the large ones annually, have to have a registration system. That's all laid out in the statute. But I would say we had a lot of flexibility as to exactly how we would implement those mandates.
What are some examples of some things that have been innovative or that have been particularly rewarding for you and your colleagues to have done?
I mean, just certainly the whole process of getting an inspection system up and going is one. I remember we had a meeting in a conference room at Baker & McKenzie after we'd all been appointed, but before we even had office space, where we decided that in our first year we would conduct inspections of the four largest firms. Now, the statute didn't compel us to have those inspections in that first year, and at that time we had no staff at all, no plan for how to conduct an inspection, really no knowledge of what an inspection report would look like, nothing. But we made that commitment, and we were fortunate to be able to hire some really top-notch people with backgrounds in accounting and auditing, including George Diacond, who was our director of inspections and registration, and who came to us from the NASD, and get that process going. And at the same time, we set up an office of risk assessment to help the inspection staff focus on, you know, not simply looking at audits broadly, but on what seemed to be the riskiest or the most difficult or the most problematic part of particular audits. And that's certainly something that's still evolving and will probably always be evolving. But I think that's one of the big challenges, to make sure that we're not just looking at the sort of at the mechanics, at the box checking, but that if we're really focused on what's the difficult part of this particular audit, where are the challenges, where might some sort of a mistake or oversight have occurred.
Is this also a way to improve efficiency, to get things done?
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, it's better to spend time looking at things where there could be an issue that really has an impact on the investing public rather than just, you know, looking broadly. Yeah, so absolutely. And probably, from a big picture standpoint, or from a newspaper reader standpoint, the most difficult issue we've grappled with over the last 5 years has been internal control reporting. We had auditing standard number two, and a lot of complaints, I think some justified, some not, about the efficiency of the auditing process that that led to, and so now we replace that with auditing standard number 5, and it's in very intellectually and politically and in a bunch of other ways, you know, challenging process to make Congress's idea of auditors reviewing the effectiveness of internal controls work in a way that's both meaningful but doesn't break the bank in terms mm-hmm. of what it's costing companies to, you know, to pay their auditors to do this work.
So you're going on 5 years or something like that. How does it feel like you're still putting this thing together and figuring out how to make it work, or does it feel like you're starting to maintain the organization?
Well, I think there's still a lot of feeling of sort of, you know, newness about it, and there, you know, there's still some basic things that we're putting in place even after 5 years. I mean, we're currently, you know, just on the verge. The statute clearly envisions that we would have not just a registration system for auditing firms, but a reporting system so that they periodically update the information they have on file with us for our benefit and for the public's. And we're just about to put those annual reporting rules in place. We've got, I think, around 860 non-U.S. firms registered with us. They're not all actually engaged in U.S. auditing, but many are, and we're still developing our relationships with foreign regulators as to how we're going to conduct inspections in, I think it's like 60 countries that these mm-hmm. firms are spread across, or as many of which don't have English as their first language,
right.
and some have very strong local audit oversight bodies, some don't have any local oversight bodies at all. So that, I mean, that whole, you've asked about internationalization, that whole aspect of internationalization in terms of this board's work is still something that's is very much unfolding.
Are you working with IOSCO and organizations like that?
We're not really working with IOSCO since we don't count as a government regulator,
right.
So we're not,
right.
I guess, eligible for membership. There's been a group set up recently called IFIAR, the International Forum of Independent Auditing Regulators. I think I have their acronym right. Which is like sort of like a version of IOSCO for audit oversight bodies around the world.
How many of them are there?
I think that group must have, I would guess, in the range of 20 or 25 members currently. Many countries are either creating or restructuring their audit oversight bodies, and in many cases to be more like the PCAOB, in other words, more independent from the profession than what they've traditionally had. So it's a very, I don't know, evolving area in terms of the international picture of how auditors are regulated.
That's interesting. So Sarbanes-Oxley is sort of having an international impact.
Yeah,
in some respect.
I mean, for all the criticism that you can read of some aspects of our Sarbanes-Oxley, Title I, the part that created the board, if imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, then a lot of other countries are flattering us by trying to develop their own PCOBs.
Well, at this point, I generally ask if there's anything that we've left out that we should talk about, insight from your experience. I know you said earlier that your time in the General Counsel's office was probably the most rewarding point in your career.
Yeah, I mean, again, I largely comes down to the terrific people that I work with, both other people on the staff of the commission and the commissioners and chairmen that came through the agency in those mm-hmm. 16 years, and along with it's sort of hard to capture. I mean, a feeling of collegiality and common purpose that I guess in honesty, I would have to say it eroded somewhat over the 16 years that I was there, but I think it was still a strong characteristic of the commission. And in some ways, you could you can feel like you were part of a spirit that ran back to 1934, and I know the sense of crisis they had in those days that the capitalism and the markets might collapse, and then it was important that the SEC save them. And I think that's spirit has really been important to keeping the commission the premier agency that it, that it is throughout the decades after the 30s.
Yeah, hopefully it won't go away.
That's right. I understand why people feel that the commission isn't or hasn't been large enough to perform its job. I've always been a little uneasy as the size of the agency increases, because I think it's harder to maintain that collegiality and sort of prioritization of work. When you're a little shorthanded, then you concentrate on the most important problems rather than the less important ones. But.
Well, it's a good sign that so many SEC people are interested in their history, too.
Well,
so,
yeah.
I appreciate you taking some time to talk to me.
Oh, it's been fun to do it.
Great.
Glad to be able to.